Hello, bonjour, and welcome to Canuck as a Slur, a podcast about cool, cursed, curious, cringe, clubbing, cranky, car jumping, and kid-friendly Canadian culture and history. I am Kelly, and this time around, we're doing something a little different. You're going to listen to an interview between me and two guests. One is Duncan Ireland, visual artist and storyteller, a friend of mine who, along with his partner Sarah, have graciously allowed me to stay at their house a few months to work on this podcast. He's currently putting together an online show for all ages as Unky Dunky, and you'll find his link tree in the description to this episode. The other guest is Fred Penner, who many of you may recognize as a children's entertainer, possibly even from your own childhood, whether that was on the CBC television show Fred Penner's Place or through listening to his albums. For a while now, Fred has been Duncan's mentor through an arts accelerator program that he took, and Fred was kind enough to agree to take part in this three-way conversation for Canuck as a Slur. In it, we talk about the art scene in Canada generally over time, comparing Fred's experiences as a well-established artist, who's still going, by the way, Duncan and I saw him perform live in Edmonton just a few months ago, and it rocked, to our own positions as, well, aspiring amateur creators. So consider this fair warning. This is a very sincere episode, probably as sincere as we'll ever get on this show. Yes, it was a challenge for me. While we're at it, this is as good of a time as any to remind you, both Duncan and I have Patreon, so if you have anything to spare, consider checking those out in the description and help us get compensated for the work that goes into everything we make. In our case, you'll also get access to some bonus episodes, which includes more Duncan. Anyway, with all that preamble covered, let's now jump right into the conversation. Enjoy.
For he goes burning down and down Whitewater, that's where the log driver learns to step lightly. It's burning down and down Whitewater, a log driver's waltz pleases girls completely. Burning down and down Whitewater, a log driver's waltz pleases girls completely.
Hello and welcome back to Canuck as a Slur. Today we have a very different sort of episode. We have two guests today. So I am Kelly, and with me today, first is Duncan Ireland, an aspiring all-ages entertainer.
Hello.
Hello, Duncan. And we also have Fred Penner, a longtime all-ages entertainer.
Kelly, Duncan, hello, hello.
How are you both doing today?
Delightful.
Yeah, I'm well, thank you.
So today, with having two guests, we want to kind of facilitate a discussion between our two guests and understand why these two guests. I want to get into what is your relationship to each other. So does one of you want to explain that?
Yeah, I did a arts accelerator program. And upon graduating that, there is a mentorship program. And I was told I could ask for anybody and they would try and make it happen. And as a storybook performer, there's not many people who I thought could be like a mentor, but Fred was one of them. So I asked asked Jerry if she could reach out to Fred, and she did. And Fred said he'd be willing for a preliminary conversation. And we had that. And I think that went well because we're continuing to talk.
Exactly. Yeah. So the contact was made. How long ago was that now, Duncan?
Almost 9 or 10 months. I think it was.
It hasn't been a year yet. I'd have to go back and check my timing. Yeah. So we've had sporadic regular contact for that many months, and talked about a lot of things and built something together, you know, in a friendship and mentee world. Mm-hmm. and I find you an interesting character, and how things are evolving for you is very interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah, so for a bit of clarity on that, you didn't have a pre-existing relationship with this school, right, Fred?
No, not at all.
And I think Fred was the first person you asked for, right? Like that was your first?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's not that you were in a stable of existing mentors, but you were kind of proposed, hey, this person wants you to be his mentor. Mm-hmm. And you had a choice to say yes or no, right? You could have said, I'm just busy right now, or this guy's, he smiles too much, or whatever the reason would be. I'm kind of curious what made you go like, no, this is something I would like to take on.
Well, I've thought of this over the years. I've had a number of people who are interested in getting into the world of family children's entertainment, asking me to critique their work, whether it's books or music, you know, because after 50 years on the road, I've established a bit of a reputation, you know, certainly across North America and other parts of the planet. And people have seen me in many configurations and are looking, if they're looking for someone who knows about the industry, who has a pretty solid perspective on what entertainment is for children from my point of view. So they've come to me asking for some direction. You know, people saying I'm a children's entertainer. How can I get better? How can I, you know, become like you in some manner? And so I'll tell them why are you doing this? I'll ask them questions, you know, to see where they are in their journey. And when it came to Duncan, you know, I didn't immediately say yes. I said, I don't know this person. You know, I'm not going to jump in and commit to something. And then a couple of weeks later, say, what have I done? So first thing I told Duncan, as he alluded to, was a preliminary conversation. Let's have a chat, see whether there's a fit, see whether I get a grasp of what you are doing, and then however things unfold beyond that, we'll see.
I also did mail Fred a couple of my unfoldy books, so that yes. as we yeah. did talk and I kind of read him the story that I read to everyone, he had a copy in front of him to hold, which I thought would add to the experience of like what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was fabulous. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I think that is a good approach to kind of saying, well, let me get to know this person before I commit to anything, because that's the mistake Duncan did make, because he jumped into a full-on contract of being my friend when he met me. And now he has so many regrets, but he got locked into like 15 years. So,
well, that's obvious, but let's just try and get through the show, okay?
Oh, this is what we say every recording, yeah. So there's one thing that you mentioned there, Fred, which is that people will come up to you and say, like, I want to be you or want to be like you. I think that is an interesting topic I kind of want to pop into here. In a way, there's no way to be you specifically or be like you that closely, I think, from today's perspective, because, I mean, everything about the industry has changed, right? When you started becoming the you that people recognize, this was in like the 1970s and the 1980s, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we live in a different world now. And I think that is
that's a fact.
Yeah. I think that's kind of some of the stuff I wanted to hear you both talk about today is obviously Duncan chose you requested you as a mentor because he saw something in what you brought as a performer and as an entertainer and as a creator that he obviously admired and wanted to, like, I'd use the word emulate without being someone, but this is something that I think Duncan and I are talking about all the time is like, what are the realities of how do you become a children's or even an all ages entertainer in 2025?
Yeah, really.
Yeah. I wonder if either of you want to kind of jump in on like, what are the differences and how do we navigate that?
From my point of view, when things began, when I started focusing in, cause I, in the 70s, when I began my career, I was traveling, you know, across the country in a couple of bands and doing a lot of acting, you know, both stage plays, musical comedy, serious drama, building my personal creative chops. And then when things in the latter part of the 70s evolved to my recording the first album, The Cat Came Back, the industry was truly wide open. There were just a handful of performers who were focusing there, myself, Sharon Lawson, Bram, and Raffi. And we were all committed to bringing quality music to the baby boomers' children. And that was the difference, is we had this huge demographic, one of the largest demographics in history, who were having children and really wanted quality for their kids. So they put the demand essentially on us, and Sesame Street also evolved from that same energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so things began to build really quickly, certainly across Canada and the U.S., but mainly in Canada with children's festivals, started popping up, you know, from coast to coast. And in the early 80s, Vancouver was the sort of pivot of kids' fests in this country. Cirque du Soleil was the first, one of the first performers to be at the Children's Festival in Vancouver.
Oh, interesting.
So they were really connected on a very powerful level globally with performers who worked in every genre with children, from dance to puppetry to music, the whole thing. So it all sort of, you know, became a conglomerate, which the audiences were gobbling up. You know, so I was selling tons of records. Certainly Raffi and Sharonos and Bram were the same. We were selling out concerts, you know, coast to coast. It was really an incredibly vibrant time, particularly in the 80s. After touring and doing, I think I had three albums anyway, by the mid 80s, 85, my life turned upside down when CBC called me and asked if I would like to do a TV series. And this kind of thing, you know, in the comparison with now and then, that would never happen. CBC would never basically give a cold call to somebody and say, we like what you're doing. Do you want to do a series? And I said, sure. And they said, what do you want to do? And it was, God, what do I want to do? Well, I don't know. You know, let me think about it.
Right.
And so that put the pressure on me to truly try and figure out, here I am. There's a huge momentum happening. What is it that I want to bring to a television audience? And this is what I say to every performer who is trying to emulate anything that I'm doing is, as I said a little earlier, is why do you want to do this? What is your motivation? Where is it coming from? Are you hoping to make $1 million? Good luck. Because children are the most vulnerable segment of society, and I'll be dipping into a sort of rhetoric along the way.
Oh, hell
the children
yeah.
are the most vulnerable part of our society. What we present to them can make both a positive and a negative difference in their lives. So you really need to get a foundation in your spirit, in your soul, of what you feel you have to present to another human being, child or adult. And everything you do is based on that. And so for me, I had a sister who was born with Down syndrome. And when I was growing up, music with her was, I wasn't playing at that point. This is in my early teens. I didn't start playing guitar till I was 15. But with Susie, we'd listen to records together and cry together and laugh together. And so I learned about the power of music for Susie. So when anybody asks me, what is your core of why you do this? I always go back to the Down syndrome world, to Susie and how powerful she was in my understanding of that. You know, then it built from there. So I've been incredibly fortunate over this many years to have been given this opportunity to do, you know, 13 seasons of a television series, to produce 13 albums, coincidentally, you know, 13 to 13, and have still received accolades from all over the world for what I did and what I am doing. I don't know how an entertainer now can achieve whatever status I've achieved, because it's more complicated because of the technology. It's easier to get out there, but there's something missing about the understanding of what the steps are to ultimately get to a place where you have a persona, a reputation, a celebrity, or whatever that is. So that's my opening babble here.
I think I just want to comment on one of the things you mentioned was like the energy that you bring in. And I think that would be my hunch as to how do you navigate this today is you can look at somebody who did this 50, 60, 40 years ago, and you can want to emulate their energy, but you have to have a very different strategy, if that makes sense. Like the energy is that what you bring as the person and what you felt from that performer growing up. But because for all the reasons you just listed, the industry or industries are so different, you have to take a different approach. You know, right? You can't read, watch your interviews or read a biography of you or read your Wikipedia and say, I'm going to do this. This is my roadmap, because that I don't think would work.
Yeah.
So that thought that I had coming in that I figured was probably going to be in the answer to the question, and I think you really hit on it, is that I sometimes feel a bit envious of people in a lot of creative industries of your era, which is like it had more gatekeepers and more kingmakers and more obstacles in a way, but those kind of the platforms and those outlets were there because the CBC was there to give you a show. Record labels existed to give you a record deal. Today, it is a bit more democratized because any of us can go buy a microphone and buy a webcam.
Yeah.
But it's also, you are awash in, like, every market is saturated. Every medium is saturated.
Yeah.
And I think this gets to Duncan, the answer of why he wants to do this. A lot of these media are saturated in slop, because the feedback you were getting from your friends was, there's a lot of children's content out there and it's terrible. You know, like I think compared to that description of what things were like in and around the 70s, when it was, there's this big market and someone needs to tap into it.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to now, when it's we're saturated with creators and it is hard to capture the audience.
Yeah, on a broader scale, certainly. On a local scale, if you want to spend your time, you know, going to schools, making that kind of connection, that's open. I mean, teachers need input. They want to expand what the children are receiving. You know, certainly what Duncan has is so unique and different. I can see teachers being excited about that. But how do you take that to another level, to a provincial, to a national level, really?
Yeah. Do you want to speak to that? You've been so quiet. So you've been so polite.
Yeah.
You threatened to be polite and you've delivered on that threat. So what do you think of all that, Duncan?
My strategy in trying to make a children's entertainment and children's and family entertainment show is to not depend on social media. I bring a physical storybook out into public and to schools, and I read it to people, and I say their names when I read the story. I ask them what their name is, and I say their name in the story. And I'm trying to go one person at a time, making a connection with them in this real world, because I feel if I post any of my stuff on social media, it just becomes part of the wash of, like, it's a scroll. Whoosh, you can see it. It's gone. So instead, I would rather make a literal giant scroll that people can write in and draw in and, like, have a tangible experience and connection and community versus a trickster trapped in glass that you're looking at. And, like, tricksters are, they're fun to play with, but you're always going to lose. That's the nature of the trickster. You lose your time when you engage.
Mm.
This is sort of a thing that you and I got into yesterday, which is, like, your energy is fantastic because you're always, like, polite. You're always giggling. And, like, when you look at these projects, like, we couldn't just bring over your giant scroll and put it in the camera here because it's massive. It doesn't fit in this little blanket fort we've created. It's exciting to, like, tell people about and to show people. And then my contention was, like, the energy you have nailed down. What is the strategy? Because it is, as I was kind of saying, it's just so hard to get yourself out there these days. It's hard to package that.
I think it's hard to package it in the way that A/B testing says I should package it.
Okay.
But I choose not to try and, like, emulate anything I see on TV or internet now. Like, when I am making something, when I know it's done, it's because I want to show one of my friends to see if I can make them laugh or roll their eyes. When I'm filming an episode of the show, I'm thinking about my niece or my nephew or one of my friend's kids. Like, specifically, I'm talking to them about doing this, like, making a craft, instead of, like, reaching out to everyone and trying to get everyone's attention. It's no, I'm trying to engage with one person at a time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So Fred, when you started Fred Penner's Place and you were asked like, make a show and you're like, sure. Now what to do? Yeah. Did you start with a mission statement or like a core principle that you wanted to guide the show?
Yeah. I think because one of the important parts of my early life was exploring, was being outside. We lived, I lived in many different houses in my elementary. I went to six different schools from kindergarten to grade six because my dad was in the army and we bounced around, lived in Ottawa for a bit. So I was, as a preteen, I was exploring the world. And we sometimes lived close to a wooded area, and I would go out and I would explore. I was in Cubs and Scouts, and when we'd go on little excursions, little hikes, and learn about marking your trail so that you can follow it back. So putting twigs down on the ground, like an arrow, so you know what direction you're going. Notching a tree. Whatever, but natural things that help you get to where you're going and get you back to where you started, kind of thing. So I clearly did not want a knock knock on the door like Mr. Rogers, knock on the door, come on in. I wanted it to be because life is a journey. I wanted the viewer to feel like they were going on a journey to get to my place. So the opening montage initially was me running across a field, doing a very specific kind of turn around a tree, going to a fence. Okay, this is a marker. And so I'm following this fence to here, and then I'm going around that corner, and I wave at animals or whatever. But that's the path. You go here. You go to the tree, you go to the fence, and then finally, this was like a true godsend. The brilliant part of it all was, how are you going to get into this place of mine where it's protected, where it's truly a protected space? Mm-hmm. What could be better than crawling through a hollow log? Mm-hmm. And so you lift up the branches and crawl into the space, and then the show began. As I came through the log. So all of those elements were really important ultimately to create a safe, physical and emotional environment for the kids to visit. Because once you were in my place, you could only get there by following the steps and the path that I had already indicated. Mm-hmm. So we're now together in this environment to explore, to sing, to tell stories. Friends would drop by sometimes, where they would share their stuff, and we would create a 15-minute or a half-hour program that would carry the viewer through a creative journey, whatever that was. So I definitely had that natural environment needed to be part of my trip. And that there's another story of how the log evolved, which I'll share with you at some point if you'd like.
Yeah.
Again, philosophically, I thought, what do I want to present to this audience? And how is that going to happen? And so I did my soul searching as I do whenever I'm writing a song, think about it. I put myself into a younger state, and then start to imagine how I would have felt in a younger, vulnerable time of life. And then that helps me figure lyric and et cetera.
Yeah. I think that idea of still accessing your inner child as an adult is really important to creating all ages content, children's content that is like accessible and authentic, I think is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Because if you make something by committee or you make something by saying like, well, this is what's trending on YouTube right now, and this is how we tap into that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not something that sticks with you or really is as evocative. Because when you mentioned the log, this came up, we talked about your show and your music a little bit for an earlier recording we did. And what we talked about was like that intro of crawling through the log is like the thing that the first thing you remember years later as an adult when someone brings up the show, because it was so evocative as a kid, because you thought as a child sitting there watching TV, I want that. I want to crawl through a log to get to a secret area so bad.
Yeah.
And I think it's actually quite relevant because so all of these blankets that are around us, not all of them that you can see on cameras, were
we made an elaborate blanket fort.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah. There was the seed of like strategic thinking to that, which is like put up blankets and styrofoam and all these things because it helps with the sound treatment, the sound baffling to make the recording sound nicer.
Yeah.
But when you do it with blankets, like the first time I showed up into a video-based recording in this environment in the way we had it set up before, with this giant blanket that's now the ceiling behind me, like the people I was in the call with reacted because it was just, it's so noticeable and it just feels so different. In setting up for this recording we're doing right now, like Duncan and I redid this entire thing just for aesthetic reasons because we wanted it to look cool. We wanted to have this giant backdrop that's kind of split between us.
Yeah.
That is, was this just your art or was this a collaboration between you and Sarah?
I did the art. Sarah did the compiling so we could print it this large.
Right. This beautiful piece of art they made together. But as you said, what we did was we made a blanket for it. And we're enjoying it for the same reason you liked making a blanket for it as a kid.
Mm.
And even the way we have to sneak in behind me here to get through the blankets of sound baffling, it's a bit like crawling through a log. Like there's...
Okay.
And I think that's why it's fun to do this is because... we're making it in a blanket fort.
Yeah.
Sure. No, I get that. I get that.
I have another question.
Yep.
As you mentioned, you, in your writing process, you go back to an earlier state of yourself. If you could go back and meet your five-year-old self and ask them one question, what would you ask them?
Asking a five-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, at 5 years old. You know, personality is just starting to be formed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you're putting the pieces of your existence together, and trying to be whatever that's demanding. I mean, I came from an alcoholic family. My dad was alcoholic and a very heavy smoker. You know, so there were elements within that that I observed and had to deal with that made me feel more be the good boy, don't ruffle feathers, be the best kind of person you possibly could be, so that the challenge of the family unit isn't compromised.
Hmm.
You know, I mean at 5 years old I was less aware of all of that. Mm-hmm. But I think just being a good boy, I've always wanted to be the good boy. I don't know if there's any question I would have asked myself at that point, but just the excitement of life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in later years, I would ask, what does this world have in store for me? It took a long time for me to really figure that out. Yeah, interesting thought, though, going back to 5 years old.
I think I would ask my five-year-old self, could we read your favorite book together?
Hmm. Well, there's a thought.
I didn't even think of whether I had an answer to that question. It's interesting because so often when people talk in this area, they talk about the advice they would give their younger self.
Yeah.
But not the questions they would ask their younger self.
I don't think advice to a five-year-old would ever retain in the five-year-old's head. I want to know what they're thinking. I want to know what they enjoy. I don't remember my favorite book at five, but I'm sure if I asked my five-year-old self, I'd be very excited to tell me and to probably not be able to read it, but know it enough that like through the pictures, you could retell it.
Yeah.
And then just with my five-year-old self, go through a story.
I think if I had to ask that question to myself, maybe there's a better way to phrase it, but I almost just want to ask that small me, what do you want to do? And not in like a very structured way, like I want to read a book, I want to watch this TV show, it's that the sense of remembering what being 5 years old felt like was I always wanted to do very specific things that were maybe a bit off the path.
Mm.
I think one of the ones we talked about earlier in our last recording was, you know, if we were driving somewhere on a camping trip and we had a destination in mind, right? We are driving from here to the campsite. We're driving from the campsite to the trailhead for hiking. And I would always look out the window at these little patches in the trees or spots by creeks and rivers. And I would want to just kind of go be in them. And a lot of that personality, I think, has carried through to my adult life is sometimes I really want to do something like very specific. And it doesn't like something that doesn't come up as obvious as like read a book or watch a movie. It's like, I want to putter. I want to do this very like specific and odd thing. Like last night I spent several hours puttering, just setting this all up and putting on this, like the floor padding under us. And it was so satisfying to my brain to just say like, we're not going to be destination based. We're not going to be goal based. We're just going to kind of like be tactile and feel around and like, and just indulge in what I want to do rather than the activity I feel like I should be doing. And I feel like that's like, I guess I want to ask my young self that because I want to tap into like, that's the authentic like inner child in me is throw away all of the expectations of what you should do. What do you want to do? What do you feel like doing right now? And just see what like a kid who really gets to do what they want is going to do given the choice.
Hmm. Well, that's the basis of Montessori schooling is, and if you're aware of any of that, my two of my kids went through Montessori training to do that. And I thought it was just fascinating because they have and this was in elementary, school, like preschool, and the kids had stations. Like there was maybe a reading station or a drawing station or a music station, a variety of things that would be interesting to some child. And so basically it's here's the palette of things that you can choose. What do you want to do? Mm-hmm. And always putting that on the child. What catches your eye? Instead of saying, here's this thing that you're going to do, here's the pen, draw a picture. But I don't want to draw a picture. I want to go play with that. So it's that sense of being able to choose the things that you want, and that's what it should be when a child is growing up, is you find your likes and your dislikes. What's your favorite food? What's your favorite game? What's your favorite book? You're learning to put your personal package together. What are the things that give you satisfaction, that make you feel warm, that make you feel love, that make you feel something positive. When you talked about going back to 5 years old, I mean, this is very much a therapeutic process with a fellow named Richard Bradshaw. I don't know if you know that name or not.
I don't.
He does, basically primal therapy. And so with an adult who is, who has gone through trauma in a lifetime, which we all have at some point, Richard Bradshaw tries to make a reconnection with the child. So basically the inner child that you're talking about. And he does it in such a beautiful way. He says, think of a house that you lived in at some point in your younger life. What does the door look like? What color is the door? Open the door. Step inside. Take off your shoes. Yes or no? Are there stairs? Go up the stairs. Are there rooms? Where's the bathroom? Da, da, da. Open a door. There's a child sitting in that room. That's you. Go over and give that child a hug. So you're it's creating the atmosphere that allows you to reconnect with that vulnerable child of yours. And then it can often become a very emotional release for a person to do that. But it's really important, I think, allowing yourself to go back to your formative time and exactly what we're doing here and think about what are the values that you started putting together, you know, at that early time of life? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think even understanding what was, so like I did a sort of like therapeutic medicine retreat a few years ago, and they kind of, I think they certainly involved that approach of like, they want us to bring a photo of ourselves as a child and like start off with tapping into that sense of the inner child. There was sort of like a metaphor they used to kind of understand of like that inner child is the most authentic and pure you, and that everything else you've kind of built since then is layers on top of that. And a lot of those layers, I think, very much like trauma informed and very much informed by just the container that you're in, it's social expectations and all these things that are layers on the authentic thing. And how can you strip away the layers to see like what is the thing that you really want at the core? Like that's what I hear when you're saying that, like that we can do this exercise as adults.
Yeah.
Part of us that's still the child there is so important because that's going to inform like what can we do to be happy in this moment and happy in our day to day.
Yeah, it's a complicated world that we certainly are in now. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's always like that. Maybe it's always complicated for just to navigate humanity, to navigate an insane world, and it's always insane. You know, when you're trying to get so many people to just live and work and enjoy and be, you know, be present and, you know, before they die. Mm. It's really important to go in as deep as you possibly can to those elements that created you and that have caused trauma, and try and heal some of the trauma. Mm. You know, I some people don't buy into that, but you know, they think, well, this is the way I am. But it's just important to analyze the character you are and the values that you want to bring forward. I mean, I wonder with some of these political figures right now and the lying and deceit and the rest of that that's happening, you know, all over North America, well, all over the planet, truly, but particularly in North America right now, as we see the political things crumbling. When they go to bed at night, you know, what are these people thinking? What is Trump actually thinking? You know, what kind of trauma did he go through as a child? Mm-hmm. You know, and boy, he needs some healing. But that's a whole other side.
I think it's a relevant side because right now what we're talking about like nice things, children's entertainment. But what we've spent a lot of time talking about on this show, which is kind of looking at Canadian culture, Canadian history, but in a way that is, I think, kind of critical in those observations. What I look when I look at the things that feel very insane around us and the things that are very troubling, especially politically, is I always try to cycle back to that understanding of like what made the person this way.
Yeah.
Because I'm really biased towards a trauma-informed model. I'm like a big fan of like Gabor Mate's writing, which I'm guessing is maybe something you're somewhat familiar with, or?
No, I'm not.
Okay. He wrote a really excellent book on addiction in the realm of Hungry Ghosts, which I always recommend to people.
Tell me the name.
Gabor Mate, GABORMATE. So the book is In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. It's a bit dense, but it's so good at explaining addiction through the lens of trauma. And even like from a scientific perspective, you know, he is a medical doctor, explaining how... for example, like I'm really gonna not quite get the science of it, but if you're not being held as a child, this has an effect on the development of your brain's reward circuits.
Yeah.
And how you relate to things like your body's like endogenous opioids, and that predisposes you to have an addictive reaction to an opioid, whereas somebody who was held as a child is more likely to be the kind of person that can take an opioid painkiller and not magically become addicted, which is still how a lot of people view drugs and addiction.
Okay.
Yeah. This is like me getting into the rhetoric because this is something that I've worked in and I feel so strongly about. We still misunderstand addiction so much, but you can kind of branch that understanding out to use a really umbrella term, like an antisocial behavior, which is like not pro-social.
Yeah.
Meaning you're doing something that is causing problems for you and or everyone else, which is like using drugs in a way that is detrimental for your life, or having a gambling addiction, or having an anger problem. There's so much of this that can be traced into like this. This doesn't just happen. Something happened to you that caused this layered adult personality to manifest in this way.
Exactly. Yeah.
And what was it? And even I think things that are not that, like things that might be harmless aspects of our behavior, are still informed so much by the early childhood environment. As you said, children, the most vulnerable demographic. Mm-hmm. So that's my rant.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. Thank you for that. I'll look up Gabor Mate.
Speaking of the crazy world we live in that seems to get more intense every day with certain people's actions, Fred, what do you think builds community? Maybe not in today's modern sense, but like from your experience, your lifetime experience, what has been the strongest examples of building community in your life?
Well, I mean, the obvious thing is friendship, awareness, and I was going to say tolerance, but that's not the right word. Acceptance of the people around you, you know, being open and communicative in your environment. Community is exactly that. It's many people, many families. Doesn't have to be huge. I mean, in my little space here on Vancouver Island, we have neighbors on all sides, but there's much distance between us all, you know, like 100 yards any path. Mm-hmm. But we watch out for each other. You know, if one of us is away, what car is that? Who's doing that? The sense that we are all in this together. Maybe that's the essence of community, is we are not alone as, you know, the solitary humans on this planet. We are all in this, again, insanity together. And the only way that we're going to make it through with any kind of positivity is by being aware of that and helping when we can and being open to each other's emotions. And situation. The first year we were here, you know, we didn't know what winter was going to be like on the island, you know, because coming from Manitoba, well, I know what that is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, get your shovel and your snowblower ready. But we weren't necessarily expecting snow here, and sure enough, this dumping happened because the atmosphere, it's heavy and it's thick and it's gone in just a few days, but when it hits, it stops everything. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have shovels, and our neighbor came over without any prompting and cleared our driveway. You know, so there's community. You know, you do something for your friends, for your neighbors without having to ask.
Yeah.
You know, wherever you are, being open to the other person and feeling what they're feeling, being empathetic to what people are going through. You know, if you're however you're suffering, can I help somehow? You know, do you need anything? You know, I heard that your child is sick. I'm going to the store. Can I pick something up for you? You know, just being a little more selfless in this world. You know, and not so egotistical, not so just concerned about this body, but being open to the rest of you. So, I mean, that's many, many aspects to what community is, but just being, again, trying to be a good person. I'm going back to my 5-year-old, trying to be a nice guy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, going back to children's entertainment, and I mean, when Duncan has been telling me recently about the ideas for episodes and what are we going to talk about and what is going to be kind of imparted. And I think that is, for one thing, a bit of a difference between, I think, the style of children's entertainment you're going for, which is like, we can kind of learn something pertinent with every, you know, episode we do or every segment we do, versus you can make children's entertainment that's just bright colors and things happening.
Yeah.
And there's a real, I think, energetic difference in how you go into both of those things. And what's funny about, you know, we're coming back to like the complexity of the modern world and why do adults behave this way? And something that kind of astounds me, because me and everyone kind of our age, like we were growing up on a lot of this kind of children's entertainment. So Fred Penner's Place was one, Mr. Dress-Up was another, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was another, Sharon Lewis and Bram. Like from my memory, a lot of this stuff taught you lessons like, I mean, even they taught this in school, like it's good to share with people, right?
Yeah.
It's sure. good to listen to people and understand why they're doing the things they do. And these yeah. are things that we do teach to children. And I think children can say this to you, like they learn these things and then they seem to forget a lot of them as adults. Really, really yeah. basic yeah, things really. Like it's nice to share.
yeah.
So another really fantastic piece of Canadian content I listen to is Crackdown. It's a podcast about like the negative impacts of drug prohibition and what that is doing to people. It's all very relevant to what we're talking about, like the misunderstanding of addiction and trying to cure it with violence and policing instead of with supporting people and helping people. And one of the things that is really present in the discourse right now is they say, oh, diversion. People are diverting their hydromorphone. They're giving it to other people. And this is why we have to control everything so tightly, because yes, I prescribed this to you, but you diverted it to your friend. And they made this point on the show, which is very important to me, is when we're talking about children, we call that sharing.
Yeah.
It is sharing. It is absolutely the same thing. I have something, you don't have any of it. We both need it for the same reasons. I have extra, I'm going to give you some. That is sharing. But in a different context, it becomes so stigmatized in a way that hurts people. And I'm so mystified and saddened sometimes by simple, basic lessons that are taught to us as children that don't stick with everyone.
I agree. I concur on that one. You know, how adults have lost that perspective, lost the real beauty of what it means to be caring about your fellow human being. It's tragic. And what do you do?
I think for me, community is very much a conscious effort and awareness of being inclusive.
Yeah.
Is the thing Kelly and I were talking about yesterday, where like it's an effort to be inclusive. It's you have to be aware of the bigger picture of activities and social events and like making an effort to make sure everyone feels welcome and included.
Yep, there you are. That's a good one. Something both my wife and I do on a regular basis is when we go to a store, you know, and so often the serving staff, you know, any kind of grocery store, whatever, are going through their motions. You know, they're taking the item, they're scanning it, scanned, and they're wearing a name tag, so use the name, you know. So after after the course of you've done the job. How are you doing today? Thank you, Duncan. Thank you, Kelly. Mm-hmm. You know, have a great day. You know, see you again. Whatever. It's about identity.
Yep.
That's a huge word. You know, for every human being is what is your identity? Who are you? Who are the people in your life who brighten your world? Mm-hmm. You know, when you walk into a room. You know, is there an excitement that people feel, you know, from your presence, you know, just learning how to be a better human being, you know, more opening, more giving and all of that.
Yeah. I really resonate with when you say identity, when you're having the jumping off point for our conversation was community. I kind of broke my worldview into this framework many years ago now, and it only becomes more true for me with time, which is that like the three main things that people want, or I would say people need to really feel good, like to feel okay, are purpose, identity, and community. That's how I look at it, and we've already named two of them just somewhat organically through this conversation. I think that is I think that's relevant to why there's a lot of, like, we are in, I would say, a mental health crisis right now. A lot of people are struggling to feel good.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of those structures, even the grocery store, as you describe it, many, many years ago, not that the past didn't have problems, but it was more likely that you were the grocer. Somebody came into your store that you owned and had an interaction with you as a person who lived in your neighborhood, and you could sell them and feel good about your business and feel good about your interactions with them. And working for Costco, I'll use that example because I worked for Costco once, strips you of all those things. You don't recognize any faces, any repeat customers. Your customers are coming from all over. You don't have the identity of the store owner because you just work there. You don't have the purpose of making the store better because you get paid minimum wage no matter what. And the structures like peel those things away from us. And that's like the kind of view I take into like, how can I make myself feel good? How can I try to make the world better? Is how can we reintroduce purpose, identity, and community?
Mm. And because we are so deeply connected with the technology now, that's lost the personal.
Mm-hmm.
The personal is harder to find, mm-hmm. where you really have to commit to it on a different level. And that's pretty challenging. I mean, who writes a letter anymore?
This guy does, for one thing. I have written a couple in like that very specific, we're going to do this for the sake of it way, mostly to respond to one that you sent me. But I've had a couple of friends who are like that. And like, it is nice when you feel like you're carving out the time to do something that is slower.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Mm, yeah.
That exercise for its own sake, even if you don't send a letter to anyone, like that's a thing that I have trouble with, is carving out the time. And I think that is relevant to the difference between how the industry works or just the sense of being a creative works. I would think you could speak to this better, Fred, obviously, but when you were starting out on TV, when you were starting out in the music industry, it seems like it was easier to be specialized because, like, if you were to do a TV interview, you would probably show up and they say, okay, here's our like hair and makeup. And then you can sit in the chair and you can talk to George Strombolopoulos, and then he's going to come with his notes. And then like, but both of you can sit down, put on your microphones, and then talk about stuff.
Yeah.
And when you contrast it with what we did here, we had to set up our own booth. We had to set up our own lighting. We had to set up our own mics. And even you, as the person who's coming externally to this, the three of us had to troubleshoot the audio together, troubleshoot the cameras together. And then later, I'm going to have to take all the recordings and edit them and post them and distribute them.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of benefit to saying you have total creative control, but it's also a part of why I don't feel like I have the time, because so much energy gets taken up in this. And I know you were saying something as well, Duncan. You have a project for a friend you're working on that you're going to take to their place, just try to work on it, because in your daily routine, you keep not finding the time.
I've been working on carving a very large sign for 3 years, and it takes up most of my desk, and I've just worked around it.
A sign?
A very large wooden sign carved, Whispering Pines Lodge.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was supposed to be for the road to like point to the lodge, but I made it too nice after a year. Now it's going to be, they're going to put it above their mantelpiece, or like above their fireplace as a mantel.
Like, it looks great. It's done. It looks beautiful.
It's taking me 3 years.
Is this a gig? Like, is this a...
Yes, a commission.
Yeah, commission. Yeah. Oh, great.
Yeah.
So when I do, put it this way, what I did last night was like a quick Wikipedia scan to get a little more of the background.
Okay.
There's a few things that of interest to me that kind of came up. So this is something that I've always looked at since I was young. And it becomes more pertinent to me as I get older, is like, at what age did someone have a break into this career, or did they begin a career? And you can maybe correct us on the dates if Wikipedia is wrong, imagine that. So it says that, so you were born in 1946, right?
Correct.
And it says by 1972, in their words, you were a full-time professional musician.
Well, no, it's not quite true. I mean, the early 70s is, I lost my sister, Susie, and my father, they died within a year of each other. Susie died in June of 70. My father died in March of 71, so less than a year apart. And that was the turning point. At that point, and I'm sure you read this, that I had earned a BA in economics from the University of Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. And so I was on the path to becoming a civil servant. You know, I'd written my government exams and I was in the top 10 percentile to fit into that little cog. And then Susie and Dad died and it was, okay, I don't want to be an economist. I know that, but I have no marketable skills. I wasn't a good student. I was very gregarious. I loved to perform. I loved to make music. I loved to play guitar. Well, let's see if this will work. And so I started playing, you know, in lounges and bars and folk clubs. And that led to this. And that led to a band I was with for 4 years. And that led to, you know, just exploring all the options of performance. And that opened up, you know, many theatrical challenges and musical as well. So the 70s from 72 to 79 were the real developmental time for my career focus. And then once I produced the Cat Came Back album, then everything changed from there.
Wow, the Cat Came Back album would have been, was that 78, 79, you're saying?
79, yeah.
So then that would have made you about 33 that year, right?
Yeah. So I was older.
I mean, that makes me feel good as a 33-year-old who's still trying to transition from the world of, you know, working in public service or working in these conventional jobs into doing something creative.
Yeah.
It's just something that's very interesting to me is like when I was 17 and I thought I would like to have a creative career. I think I want to be a writer and kind of, I would look at, you know, someone's Wikipedia page and go like, hey, this person didn't drop an album until they were 31. How does this happen? Like, what were you doing in all of your 20s? And it's like, I just like to hear that insight from people on how many steps and how many diversions did you have to take? And how many times did you think it wasn't going to pan out before you got to, that's probably like the watershed moment is I got a record and everything took off from there, which didn't happen until like the early 30s, right?
Yeah. I loved the exploring. I had very few expectations other than the immediate thing I was doing, the play I was doing, the song I was learning, the rehearsal process of doing. I loved that. And until there was another one would come along. Like I did not have a plan. There was no 5-year plan to figure any of this out. This made me feel good. Getting up on a stage in the early 70s, the Can-Can Lounge at the Balmoral Hotel in Winnipeg, $25 a night for 3 nights, $75. Are you kidding? And I just got up there and sang and people liked it and they gave me money. Great. Well, let's do another one of those and do another one of those. So it was never a plan. I never knew where it was going to go. And then over my lifetime, I mean, so fortunately, again, I get the call from somebody in Winnipeg said, why don't you audition for Rainbow Stage, an outdoor musical theater? You know, you've got a good voice. You know, and I'd never thought about doing that or, you know, at any point. So I said, oh, do you think I can do that? Yeah, well, I do. Okay, well, I'll try it. Would you like to make an album? I've never thought about making it a record. And that doing the first album just came from a doctor and his wife in Winnipeg who saw me in a performance that my ex-wife and I were doing. I'd written the music. They loved my voice. Said, do you have an album? No, I have no idea. We like your voice. We like your music. Here's a blank check. Literally, make an album. Are you kidding? Okay, well there's the turning point. Would that ever happen again? I don't know. You know, so it was like that. Those series of things. Then once the record was there, then a connection with Raffi happened, and that opened up a link with him for 5 years, and then all that touring led to CBC. Oh, there's another mark. Oh, there's another mark. Again, beyond my control, seemingly. I mean, I was still developing, working, learning the craft of songwriting. These inspirations came to me from an external source, which gave me the inspiration to try and build and create. But I did not have a plan. I had no idea where any of this would go, and still don't, for that matter.
I don't want to spend too much time on it because we are going to wrap up in a couple minutes here. But something you said about you're not sure if it would work the same way today. I think there's something that is actually, to me, quite similar in what I've seen around me with people who are creative today. And that's similar to your story of somebody noticing you and asking you, do you have an album? Like, here's a blank check.
Yeah.
Like, I think one thing that's important to note about, you know, people who come from your era who were successful is like your story has the story will always have an element of survivor bias, right?
Sure.
For every one of you, there's people who who were out there playing songs and they never got noticed and then they moved on to something else.
Yeah.
When I see people who have been very successful in creative spaces today, and I can use the example of podcasting because I've seen this like close up a few times, is people who were trying something and what they had the most was they got very lucky. Someone noticed them and said,
yeah,
hey, your audio doesn't sound very good. I'm going to come in. I'm going to fix your problems. And you can use like, you can kind of tap into our audience and then you kind of break out from there. And in a saturated marketplace, I think some of that luck needs to come in more than ever.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how that is consistently true today, is that you need a little bit of the skill of being gregarious because that helps you. Like, people just gravitate toward people they like and towards networking, like that helps you out. But a lot of luck too, of just the right person at the right time kind of has to see it and pull you a little bit out of the bucket.
Yeah.
And that's definitely a thing that, like, I think both Duncan and I need to hope for is a bit of that luck, right?
That's where shows like, you know, Canada's Got Talent, America's Got Talent, these platforms have been created for people to try and get that luck. To, you know, mm-hmm. to try and bring their ability into the form, but often without really having done any preparation to get there. You know, and I mean that's one of the hardest, saddest parts of the whole thing is there's people who want to be better, want to be that, but really don't have the skill or the impetus to learn what they need to do to go there. And because it's so easy to get a microphone, to get a camera, to put this out and then getting feedback from people, it's too easy to find some kind of visibility with people who really aren't very talented, who don't, you know, who would like that, but they don't have the ability to go the next step. And that's unfortunate. I think you lose some perspective when it's too simple like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think Doug and I are both people that will put a lot of effort into our stuff.
Clearly. Yeah.
And in Duncan's side, it's making something, I think for both of us, it's making stuff that's elaborate.
Yes.
But even for me, it's trying to make sure that our mics sound good and the cameras are pointed nicely.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's like, even though YouTube's algorithm has been tweaked a bit to say like, hey, we're serving more episodes of like, here's a podcast. It has no viewers, no subscribers. Like from the clicking the thumbnail level, this show that we put a lot of effort into doesn't have any more, you can't tell right away that it has more effort put into it than stuff that you can click on and you go, oh no, this sounds grating. It sounds awful. These people are racist, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing. It's like when there's so much muck around you, you just look like part of the muck.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do have two quick points I wanted to touch on while we still have you, and then any closing thoughts either of you have.
Sure, go ahead.
So another thing I saw on Wikipedia, so your daughter Haley is also a musician?
Oh yeah, Haley's a powerhouse.
Yeah, that seems like a whole conversation for another day, because I immediately became fascinated that she has a solo album out that has like an accompanying book, and that sounds from my really quick skimming of it, that it also touches on those themes of like, toxicity in the industry and like things that are...
Oh yeah, big time. Yeah, Haley's been living in or moved to LA about a dozen years ago, and came in as a songwriter. She was invited to, you know, to be part of a company, and she landed in LA, and they put her into a studio within a couple of hours to try and write a song with somebody she'd never met. And did really well because she's very open, she's very talented, and so that's been her journey down there of writing songs with really an interesting, you know, collection of people. I mean, just look at her, not Wikipedia, but check her out. Haley Jean, G-E-N-E Penner. There's an amazing amount of stuff. And she wrote a book a number of years ago called The People You Follow, based on her experiences in LA and the abusive situations that she got into. And I'm not allowed to read the book.
Yeah. You
know, it's one of those.
Well, I listened to the album last night when I was setting all this up.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was just a discovery. I was like, let's put this on. Really pleasant. Love listening to it.
Yeah. Oh, great.
This is just trivia, but I noticed two of the songs have these lyrics that specifically compliment you.
Oh.
So that's a ringing endorsement. That's pretty good.
Okay. Oh, good. I'm not even sure which those are.
And I noticed that, like you said, for other artists, she's written for a lot of major artists.
Yeah.
And one of those was the song Everybody Loves You on the album Gaslighter by the formerly Dixie Chicks.
Yes, right.
Yeah, which I will say is a very cool album from a very underappreciated band and a very good song. So I was like, it was just cool. I was like,
cool.
That blended in so well the album, I thought it was written by Natalie Maines, but it wasn't. So just very fun connection, nice. Yeah.
Yeah, no, she's had and continues to have a really interesting journey. She wrote her book, Chantal Kreviazic and Rain from Our Lady Peace contacted her. They've been friends on, you know, in LA, and they asked her to write their biography. So she's been writing that for the last while. That's pretty much done, I think. And she's worked on a movie script for her book, which is in the, you know, it's in the, they have the first draft done, which they're sending out to friends and, you know, starting to develop that. And at some point that may turn into a major motion picture.
Cool.
I don't know. Anyway, so she's that's interesting. Thanks for bringing her up.
Yeah, I'll have to check that book out. I became very intrigued in all of it last night. So.
Oh, great. Excellent.
The last question that I have for the group, and of course, I want to give you both a chance to say whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
So, Fred, on this show, we have kind of been developing a theory of Canadian culture and history, which is that all of it funnels through one person, and that is former Mush Music DJ turned multimedia heartthrob George Strombolopoulos. And so every episode of our story so far, we have managed to connect to Strombo. And when we talked about your work before, that was very easy because you've been on his show and you've been interviewed by him.
Yeah.
So that exercise, that part of the episode's already done. We've already covered it. So I guess what I want to know is, like, you've gotten to meet him in person. Can you speak to, like, did you get to talk to him as a person at all? Was he nice? That's what we want to know. Was he nice?
George is fascinating. He's, I think a word that I've used with Duncan before is maven. And a maven is a person who makes things happen, who just has that energy to connect with one person, you know, to say, oh, I see what you're doing. Have you talked to this person to make that happen? He's very eclectic. He's very, very friendly. He's very open. He listens really well. No, he's a fascinating human being. I like George. We haven't spoken for a while, but I think he's the real deal.
That's so good to hear, because the more, like, our last guest asked him, like, is he a cool guy? And I'm like, I think he is. I don't want the other shoe to drop on that. So it's nice to hear positive things.
No, he is.
For anyone keeping score at home now, so when playing the 6 degrees of separation game, Fred Penner is 1 degree of separation from George Strombolopoulos.
There we are.
From this conversation and the ones you've had before, Duncan and I are 2 degrees of separation from George Strombolopoulos. And anyone who has ever been a guest on this show makes them 3 degrees away. So we'll update our metrics accordingly.
Perfect. Okay.
You've changed the whole game, Fred.
Yeah, okay. Just like that. That was easy.
Yeah. Well, that was so much fun. Sweet. Thanks so much to both of you for participating
thank you, Kelly,
in this.
Very much.
As the artist that you are. I've talked a whole bunch. Duncan, you've been so polite. So I want to ask you first, is there anything else you want to kind of just throw in before we go? Like our plugs and stuff, I'll record after. We can do that after.
I would specifically like to thank ArtsLink New Brunswick or ArtsLink NB. Yeah. That's the program I did the Catapult program through.
Great.
And Jerry Nope for calling Fred and like asking if he would be my mentor and setting that up. So ArtsLink NB is an incredible organization and I want that to be in this episode.
Fabulous. Now, good for you. Yeah.
And one question for you, Fred.
Yeah.
If you could say anything to your 35-year-old self, what would it be?
Oh, question more. Be a little less trusting.
Mm. Okay.
Because that's kicked me in the butt a few times, where I assume that people are honest.
Mm.
And trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten myself into a few situations along the way that in retrospect, boy, I really missed the boat at that point. You know, I really didn't, my career, and certainly no sour grapes in any way. I'm so grateful to where, you know, what my life has, how my life has evolved. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you get into the business, really be aware of the people that you're working with and challenge what they're saying. Make sure you have a good lawyer, you know, that you're ready to talk to.
Okay.
And a cynical friend.
Yeah, there is some cynical in me right now, but that's what I would tell my 35-year-old self is, you know, pay a little more attention because these people are controlling really important aspects of your life, you know, and take the time to read carefully and to listen carefully and to respond with something. But you at that point, you still don't know what any of this means.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to trust somebody along the way. And I think I was a little, as a human being, as the kind of person I am, I just trust. And then I have to try and dig myself out of a couple of holes along the way, but there you go.
Okay. Thank you.
But it's a pleasure speaking with the two of you, on an intellectual level, looking at what this world is, you know, how we're doing. And I appreciate your awareness of the importance of doing this well, you know, from a sound point of view. Kelly, I wish you luck in editing this this little trip here.
It's all part of it. It's a different edit every time, and we have different guests. So.
yeah, good. Well, good luck on that. A pleasure speaking with you, and good luck, good fortune.
Thank you, Fred.
Peace and love.
We will all need it. All right. Everyone's good on their closing thoughts?
Yes.
Okay. We'll do the sign off. Fred, do you want to say our sign off phrase? It is a Canadian French phrase you may recognize. It's Je m'en calisse.
Calisse! I'm not sure if that's a phrase I would normally. From a French point of view, I don't think that's a word that should be spoken, is it?
Well, that's we learned it from one of the movies we covered, so.
And I learned that in 1954 in Ottawa when we lived there.
I think there is less concern about it now because they now sell stuff in all of the gift shops in Montreal and Quebec City that say Tabarnak and Je m'en calisse on them. So,
Je m'en calisse.
Canuck is a Slur is an independent collaborative effort to present a critical, progressive perspective on Canadian history and culture.
Drop them.
To make consistent, high-quality content, we need your support.
Let's tangle.
Head on over to patreon.com/CanuckIsASlur to sign up.
Beauty.
If you're still on the fence, well, here's the sales pitch. Patrons at the good old Canadian boy level unlock expanded access to our Discord server, including sneak peeks at upcoming episodes.
Let's go!
Patrons at the good old Ontario boy level will also get into our archive of bonus content, which includes an extra episode every month. Patrons at the good old Kingston boy level get to commission a free piece of bad art every month as well, in addition to further special Discord privileges.
Blue, what a pup! Oh, how she loves the Stanley Cup! Hockey man is what I am!
Let's go! Listen, listen to what I say. Play that game the Canadian way. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go!
We'd love for you to come and follow us on our various socials, which you can find linked in the episode description. You can also see any further links for our guests and co-hosts there as well. The creators of this work would like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples across the continent that had their homes stolen, land broken up by arbitrary borders, cultures suppressed, languages banned, children kidnapped, and who were subjected to many other forms of colonial violence. We also acknowledge the many treaties broken and still unceded territories across Turtle Island. Thanks for listening, eat the rich, and happy trails to you.